Derek Jensen is an author and environmentalist whose most recent book is The Myth of Human Supremacy. This is Derek Jensen. I'm Duncan Gamey. You're listening to Dunk Tank.
Great. Derek, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, what's funny is for people listening to this, right before this call, you just had to, I suppose, shoo away a bear, a mother and her cubs, from your front step, which also happened the last time we talked. Does that ever become a nuisance? How does one shoo away a bear? I get that with a raccoon or something.
I don't. I just go say hi.
Okay.
And one can shoo away bears. I do sometimes if they get too obnoxious, I will take slippers and slap them together. And usually when I do that, they will go away. Sometimes they'll just look at me like, why are you standing there slapping slippers? That seems kind of silly.
Yeah.
No, it's and I'm always aware of the fact that their families were here first, and I try to be a respectful guest on their land.
I see. And so, no, you know, and do you ever feel a need to defend yourself from these? I'm just thinking about from my perspective, where I don't have bears coming up to my home, and I would be terrified. But I suppose that's not your attitude.
No, for a couple reasons. One is that I'm inside, or at the most I have a door open and I can always shut the door. But more, so I'm gonna tell a story from,
please,
from, gosh, 20 years ago. I grew up in the country. I'm gonna tell a couple stories. I grew up in the country and in the West, and when I was 17, I went to a summer science training program in engineering at the University of Southern California. Across the country, we're all a bunch of nerds. And at one point, we went and backpacking for a day, a couple days. And my roommate and a lot of the people were urban, and they were making plans for what to do when coyotes attack. And I'm like, oh, come on. We might hear some coyotes, which would be really nice, but coyotes are not going to attack, because I grew up with coyotes. I knew them, and that's all fine. And I got to be superior. And then we went to the ocean, and a lot of these were California kids and they grew up on the ocean. And I'm terrified because I'd seen the movie Jaws, and I refused to get in the water. And they're like, oh, come on, Derek, you're more likely to get hit by lightning than bit by a shark. And I was afraid of crabs, too. I was afraid that it's sandy beach, and crabs don't really live right there. But it didn't matter. I was scared of the things I wasn't familiar with, and not scared of the things I was familiar with. And then many years later, I did a talk at this Quaker school that was also a farm. And they took me around the farm after I did the talk, and we went to the cows. And the cows were fine. I grew up around cows, and I'm walking in among these huge animals, and just, you know, if I have to walk between two of them, I just push my way in between them, and it's no big deal. And then we get to the sheep, and the sheep, we didn't have sheep when I was a kid, and the sheep were fine, except the rams made me a little bit nervous because they have those big horns, and then one of them kept trying to butt me, and the guy who was taking me around, he would just not even stop the conversation. He would just grab the ram by its horn as it came running up to me and spin it around. And then we got to the pig pasture, and they said, do I want to go in and pet the pigs? And we had just thrown watermelons to the pigs, which the watermelons crushed with their jaws. And I said, I am not getting in this pen. It wasn't a pen, it was a pasture. I'm not getting in this pasture. And they were laughing and laughing and saying, the only way these pigs will hurt you is by sitting on your lap. And I was like, I just saw them crush a watermelon. That was my skull, you know? And my point is that it's always been really interesting to me how the things that we, you know, I see bears every single day. So the first few times when I first moved here and I saw some, it was really scary. And now it's just a part of the day. And, you know, I can cite statistics. There's only one person dies every 2 years from a bear attack in North America. And there's, what, 30-some thousand die every year from car wrecks. So we should be much more scared of cars than we are of bears. But then there's also just the notion that they are just other, and this is not cosmic, it's just true. They're just other beings with it's so fun for me to watch them extend their trust. You know, the first times they see me and I walk outside, they run away as fast as they can, just like I run away. And then as we get to know each other, it's exactly like when you see a feral cat or a feral dog. You know, the first time you see it, it runs away, or you're scared it's going to bite you. And then over time, you get to know each other better. I mean, heck, it's the same with people, except we don't usually just, you know, get up and run away. But there's still, you know, somebody new walks into a room, new kid in class, you know, they, at first, everybody's sort of looking at them and they're sort of looking at everybody, and then they become comfortable over time. And it's really important to me in my own life and in my work too, to recognize the beingness of all these others and to not reify them in a different way. They aren't like, ooh, the bear spirits who are all knowing. I mean, we're all just different beings on this planet with our own issues. There have been bears over the years who have been shot or who have been trapped. And there was one bear who had either been caught in a trap or she'd been shot in her back leg, and that leg shriveled up. And that bear was always frankly mean for the rest of the time I ever knew her. And my mom would say, oh yeah, of course she's mean. Who wouldn't be mean if somebody shot you? And you're always in pain from the hurt. So anyway, I love thinking about that. I love thinking about it with plants. I love thinking about it with just, you know, the complexity of all these vastly different intelligences. And what would it be like to have very, very poor vision, but a sense of smell that is like 1,000 times stronger than ours, and a sense of hearing that's twice as strong? How would you perceive the world? How would you live in the world? It's just, I love thinking about stuff like that.
A couple things occurred to me as you were saying that. The first being that it reminded me of my prior fear of bees and the idea that if a bee gets close to you, it's going to sting you. And yet there's clearly something encoded in the bee that knows that if I sting something, I'm going to die. So, you know, they don't want to get into a fight. Like, the bear probably does not want to. There's an aversion to that sort of, because there's a risk to getting into a fight with some stranger, right?
You know, can I respond to that before you go to number two?
Please.
Yeah, you know, John Livingston, the writer, was the one who really introduced me to that concept. And he pointed out that he helped me understand that nature shows are pretty bogus, because they so often show, I mean, it's always, here we go with the two lions fighting, or there's always, and, you know, frankly, they spend a lot of their time not doing much. And most, and I've seen this, again, I see this every single day with bears, that most of the time, if there's a conflict between them, it's basically posturing. It's basically, hey, get out of my way. And then the other one gets out of their way because they don't have antibiotics. And because if they really get injured, that could mean death. I mean, if you break your arm as a bear, you can't go to the emergency room and get it taken care of. There was a bear many years ago who got shot in the face, obviously not by me or my mom, got shot in the face by somebody. And I mean, basically that bear was pretty much doomed. I mean, there's not much can happen. Right. You don't have antibiotics. You don't have a surgeon to fix your jaw. You're going to starve to death. And so a lot of the conflicts between, Okay, most of the bears I see do have scars. So, but then again, most of the humans I know have scars too. Anyway, most of the actual conflicts are only one time in the past 20 years have I seen a conflict that ended with blood on the ground. And that was, I think, six big drops. You know, somebody got, I don't remember where they got nailed, but I never actually saw where the blood came from. I just know that after the fight, there was about six drops of blood, which means somebody got somebody with a claw. But most of them are simply displays. You know, you puff yourself up. It's kind of, I love watching this in sports, or I've seen it myself when I get really mad too, that I love, you know, somebody scores a touchdown or somebody does something. What do? They puff up their shoulders and they reach their arms out a little bit. They sort of put their elbows out, make themselves, and then what they're doing is making themselves a little bit bigger. It's just like a dog raising hackles. I love that sort of interspecies similarities. And you see the same thing with bears, that they'll raise their fur and then they'll hump their back up so that they're bigger. And then if they get really mad, then they'll stand up on their hind legs, which they also stand up on their hind legs when they're curious. But the point is, two points. One is, yeah, most of their conflicts consist of yelling at each other and then one runs away. Or sometimes they'll wrestle a little bit. But even that, you know, they're not biting for the neck. They're not trying to kill. And then the other thing is that I just love is I love the idea of just, you know, it takes a long time. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about bees or ants or bears or trees or human beings. It just takes a long time of watching them in their natural habitat to sort of start to understand who they are and how they interact.
Yeah, and I like what you said about the interspecies similarities, because that was going to be what I was going to say, is that there was this primatologist I was reading recently who was talking about how a lot of biologists, for at least through the 80s and 90s, were very averse to making quote-unquote anthropomorphic statements, or trying to say something like, you know, oh, the bear was stopping by to say hello, or, you know, it's curious. It's, you know, they would say, oh, well, this is, you're trying to make this bear a human. And in many ways, not to turn these animals into humans, but to say that there are similarities and to sort of, I guess, make these creatures less foreign, I think is a good thing, no?
Yeah, I think it is. And I myself think about the language and try to, because it's not making them human. It's just, here's what I like, is something like accepting that they have personalities. Humans don't have a monopoly on personalities. I don't know if we talked about this last time, but I just love this, that somebody put a recorder that could record in the dark, obviously, in a cave full of bats, and they would record the sounds the bats made. Did we talk about this last time?
No.
Okay. They would record the sounds the bats made, and then they would correlate that to the bat behavior to try to figure out what a certain sound the bat made might mean. And they were able to come up with, first off, they found that the bats spend a lot of their time when they're roosting in caves talking. And second, they found that a lot of that consisted of, hey, you're too close, move away. Or, we don't come closer. I mean, just, it consisted of like bickering. And just the same sort of stuff that we would do if you have five children sharing a bed. I'm not saying bats are children, but if you have five children sharing a bed, you know, somebody's going to go, hey, quit poking me. And that was basically a lot of what the bats were doing. They'd figure out, you know, a bat would make a sound and then the other bat would move a little bit away. And if that happens several times, you can start surmising that perhaps the bat is saying, hey, you're too close. Anyway, it's just, this is sort of going a different direction. I'm sorry to take us in all sorts of weird directions.
No worries, please.
But it's, I've long thought, I don't think that humans are fundamentally evil. You know, some people say humans are just a plague species, and yeah, we are killing the planet. We're we're plague culture, but I don't think that humans are fundamentally, you know, like killer apes, like some people have said. I think what humans are is fundamentally contentious. You know, I think that we pick at each other. I think we get in little fights. But then I don't think that that's standard to humans either. I think that if we could decode or if we could understand a lot of songbird language, it would probably be, you really don't like my song? I mean, they'd be, you know, they'd be just gossiping. And did you see what that bird was doing yesterday? With whom? And it's the same with bears or anybody else. I think a lot of it would just consist of getting through the day. And obviously different, you know, if you live under the water and you have, like just yesterday I was interviewing somebody about whales. And some whales have been, their populations have been completely hammered. There's only a couple hundred right whales left. There were at one point 200 blue whales. They're up to a couple thousand or 4,000 or up maybe as many as 10,000 now. And one of the questions I asked is, in the huge ocean, how do you find a lover? You know, because you can't see 100 miles. You can't, and we don't know, but we think that, or some people think at least, that that could be one of the reasons that they evolved their complex songs, because some of their songs can be heard for 1,000 miles. And, you know, if you have 200 whales, you know, let's say there's 100 males, 100 females spread all over the Atlantic Ocean, how are you going to find a partner? And well, they evolved away. They can sing through long distances. So my point is, that the world is wonderfully different. I think that what we share is beingness and personality. And then beyond that, you know, the world is going to be entirely different if you're an octopus with, you know, eight arms and the ability, I think they can taste through their suckers. I don't know. Anyway, so if you, or here's just another thing that blew me away. This happened last summer, that somebody dumped a freezer off at a friend of mine's house, and I was supposed to clean it up. And I mean, I volunteered to clean it up because I got a pickup. And I went over there, and we popped open the freezer, and it had some meat in it that had been in there in this shut freezer it was really rotten. And the cool thing is that there, within about a minute, there were bunches of flies around. And within 10 minutes, there was a vulture circling overhead. So I got to thinking about that molecules of rotten meat had to go up into the air, and then they had to – there was the vulture was beyond the horizon, which admittedly was kind of close because this is a very forested area. So I was in a meadow, but there was still – this wasn't like Montana where there's a big sky. So the point, though, is that molecules had to travel up into the air and then waft over, get carried on the wind to wherever this vulture was. It had to smell them, be able to identify the direction, and then fly in between where it was and here. And that happened in 10 minutes. So, my gosh, it must be able to smell just the tiniest, tiniest little fragments of what's the word I'm looking for? Very low concentrations of rotten meat. And just, I am always, or also I had some aphids on a plant, on some plants, and I was tried all sorts of stuff and they didn't work. So I took the plants outside, and within a couple days, there were hundreds of parasitic wasps who lay their eggs in aphids. There were hundreds of parasitic wasps, and it's the same deal. They must have smelled the aphid or smelled some chemical released by the plant calling the wasps, and they all came here. And it's just, what I'm trying to get at is just how marvelous, in terms of marveling, how marvelous the universe really is, and just how, and it doesn't mean that it's all fun and happy, because for God's sake, what the parasitic wasps do is they lay eggs inside the aphids, who then grow as tiny little wasp grubs inside the aphid and then burst forth like the scene in Alien. So for those aphids, it's a very, very bad scene. So I'm not saying that life is all just, you know, fairy dust and happiness. What I'm saying is that life is really miraculous and strange. Oh, one more thing. I just learned this last night, and I have to share it because it's just the coolest thing. There's a water beetle who has evolved such that it doesn't mind getting eaten by frogs, a specific species of frog that's always in the same water. That when it gets eaten by the frog, it swims through the intestines and then basically tickles the frog's behind until the frog poops it out. And 83% of the ones who are swallowed by the frog survive. So getting eaten by that species of frog is no big deal to them. It's just, life is just marvelous.
That just reminds me about the praying mantis the male praying mantis will copulate with the female, knowing in advance that it's going to be sacrificed and eaten afterwards. Just the idea of, I don't know, giving yourself up like that, it seems so alien, especially to our perspective, where we have a very strong ego, and I don't mean arrogance or pride. I mean a very concrete sense of self, or more concrete than I suppose a praying mantis that wouldn't recognize itself in a mirror.
I'm not sure if it's a... Okay, you may very well be right. I'm just speculating. I'm just throwing this stuff out. That I sure. think... Okay, so a lot of... I don't know that it is a stronger sense of self. It may be. You may be absolutely right. Or here's the thing. I think that creatures with a low reproductive rate and a reasonably long life, a reasonably high rate of children becoming adults, have different attitudes toward death than those whose reproductive strategy is to broadcast as many babies as possible and hope that 1 out of 1,000 lives. Mm-hmm. So frogs will lay, you know, they may lay 500 eggs during the season, and the hope is that 2 of those become adults, or 1 of those become adults. Almost all of them get eaten by dragonfly nymphs or somebody along the way. And it's the same with trees. You know, a lot of trees, you know, they throw out a whole bunch of seeds, a few of them germinate, and then most of those die. Grasshoppers, you know, think about a lot of creatures whose basic, I hate talking in such utilitarian fashion, but their basic role in the community is to be food. And if there's any, unless the universe is a really, really horrible place for insects, you know, they have to have a different attitude toward death. Just they had to have, if we can presume that they have evolved psyches as well as bodies that are adapted to their circumstances, then I would hope that a praying mantis would evolve a different attitude toward death. I mean, maybe the male praying mantis is just thinking, you know, this is not a bad way to go.
Yeah.
George Carlin used to tell a joke about that he wished we lived backwards so that we would, you know, be in good shape when, you know, we would start really decrepit, and then we would become less and less so, and then we would end with an orgasm.
Yeah, exactly. That's the, I suppose when I said the sense of self, I'm sure I think you're right about what you're saying.
But you may be too. I don't know.
Well, the fact that, you know, if you put a mirror in front of a dog, unlike if you put a mirror in front of an ape or something like that, which might recognize that it's a reflection of itself, whereas, you know, a dog might just start barking at it or Have you seen those experiments before? I've just seen, you know, videos on YouTube of the different reactions of animals, and they scientists, some of them have said that this is a way of on some level certifying self-consciousness, that this creature looks at itself as an I, an individual with a certain identity. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, well, I actually wrote about that in The Myth of Human Supremacy, where I was pretty pleased with my analysis, frankly, if I can be immodest for a moment. But I said, okay, let's pretend that that somebody kidnaps you. So are you like in an apartment building or a house or what?
Yeah, an apartment.
Okay, so let's pretend that right now there are these incredibly huge, ugly aliens breaking through the window. And are you alone in the apartment or is somebody else there?
It's just me.
Okay, so in this case, they don't kill anybody. But if there were other people there, that would kill them. And then they snatch you. And then they put you in this big net and they take you away. And then they put you in some container and take you farther away. And then you finally realize that it's just like in all the bad movies, you've been kidnapped by aliens. And the aliens take you out to this space station. And then you see, you're not sure how they perceive things. They just, you can't tell if they have a face. You can't tell anything. And then you do sort of notice that they will get in front of this one object and they will preen, but you can't tell how they see. You don't know what their organs are. And then they put this object in there with you. And it's like, what? And then when they realize that you don't respond to the object the same way they do, that they then come to the conclusion that means you're not self-conscious. And my point is that this particular, the mirror test presumes that they are self-conscious and self-aware in the same way we are. But it doesn't really say anything about other modes of self-perception. And there's also another problem with it, which is I heard this discussion of, you know, tigers are not self-aware because they don't do the mirror test. It's like, oh, come on. Of course they're self-aware. They have to know when they're hungry. And the person responded, yes, the tiger is aware that it's hungry, but is it aware that it's aware that it's hungry? And I responded to that by saying, well, what about our hunger? Do we recognize that we are killing the planet? Do we recognize that we are hungry ghosts, as the Buddhists say, and that we have this hunger that can't be satisfied, and we try to fill it with watching television or with buying things, but that doesn't ever sate our hunger? Do we recognize that? And so I sort of turned the whole thing around. But before we go any further, what did you want to interview me about today? Because we've been having an interesting discussion, but I want to make sure we talk about what you wanted to talk about. And so if you want to just cut this blabbering and go Eric, I wanted to talk to you about the EU.
Yeah, no, I enjoy talking about whatever. I suppose if there was a topic, although I hate to, you know, make this so rigid, I suppose.
No, it's fine.
We're going to have a new president, and I think the rationale for many people, myself included, for voting for Joe Biden is that Trump was worse, much worse, on matters of the environment, and that getting back in the Paris Climate Agreement, reinstituting some of the regulations on coal and gas would be, if not fixing the problem, would be at least more positive steps than what Trump was taking. Now that we're starting to see some of the Biden's cabinet picks being selected, do you have any strong opinions on the new administration? Where do you see the climate movement going from here?
Well, couple things. One is that I'm afraid that, Okay, I'm not one of those people who says, oh, who sneers at other people for voting.
Right.
And I vote on local issues. I believe that that can make a difference because the numbers are smaller. And I have not voted for a Democrat since 1988 or so. And Bill Clinton really helped me understand that the Democrats and Republicans are basically good cop and bad cop. Mm. And, you know, Bill Clinton said he felt our pain as he pushed through NAFTA. And for the last at least 30 years, maybe longer, the Democrats' primary argument, and really sole argument, so far as I'm concerned, with the exception of Obamacare, which I found helpful. Anyway, with the exception of that, their primary argument has been, vote for us, we're not Republicans. And,
right.
And, you know, I've been saying that for 30 years, and the Democrats have even caught up with me. I mean, basically, their only argument with Biden is he's not Trump. And they didn't pretend that he's got better arguments. And so I respect that people, I know people who voted for Biden, and I respect their choice to do that. I'm not, in no way am I one of those people who gets really pissy about a friendship over that.
Right.
And also I know people who voted for Trump, and I completely understand that too, because it's basically the same argument. At least he's not, I mean, the left has lost its collective mind, and, you know, at least he's not an SJW. I mean, at least he's not going to push that sort of crap. And I think it's another problem I have. And I just did an interview about this. I interviewed someone about this just the other day, that it horrifies me that at one time, the Democrats at least pretended to be the party of the working class, and now they call people who vote for Trump deplorables. And
right.
I'm sorry, a lot of them are actual working class. How did blue collar people get switched over to being deplorables, to being fascists, to being Nazis? And I'm not saying I've agreed with the working class on everything. I've fought them on environmental issues many times. But this, nonetheless, I mean, I voted Green for a while, but the Greens have completely lost their mind. I voted Green back when it was Nader, but the Greens have gone completely to hell. So this particular election, I voted none.
Interesting.
Traditionally, for the last many times over the last, ever since the Greens lost their minds, I've usually just written in some friend or another. It's because I cannot bring myself to vote for, again, I respect other people who do, and this is not something I fight with anybody about.
Right.
But I cannot bring myself to vote for a Democrat. I just can't do it. Locally, at the county supervisor level, I have no problem doing that if I actually like them. But there's a problem too. So the county supervisors, one of the Democrats who was in our county got on the California Coastal Commission, which is a very powerful bureaucracy that helps decide. It's a very strong bureaucracy decision-making group to help stop destruction of coastal areas. And anyway, the local Democrat got on that, and she was one of the worst, just sort of rubber stamping a lot of developments, if you want to call them that, you know, subdivisions going in and coasts. And again, this was the Democrat. And it's just like Bill Clinton, you know, with pushing NAFTA, salvage rider, all that stuff. And then getting to Paris Accords and everything else. I've got a book coming out in March called Bright Green Lies, about how wind and solar do not actually help the planet. They are basically this is, I mean, they for one thing, wind and solar are incredibly harmful in terms of the construction of the photovoltaics, the mining involved, the actual siting of the places, I mean, siting of the harvesting facilities. It's just more industrialization. In fact, there is one study that's very interesting that shows that that argues that by 2050, industrial wind and solar will harm more wild habitat than mining, urban sprawl, transportation, and maybe agriculture, I don't remember, put together. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And this is one of the problems, is the environmental movement has been completely destroyed and been transformed from being about saving wild places and wild beings. It's been transformed from that into being about fueling the industrial economy. And that doesn't help nature. That doesn't help desert tortoises. It doesn't help blue whales. And another part that nobody ever talks about is that wind and solar don't actually substitute out for oil. And they were never meant to. They add on. They just make it so there's more energy usable for industrial use. Did we talk about Jevons paradox before?
No.
Okay, it's pretty cool, but it's pretty horrific. Jevons was an economist in the 19th century. And of course, coal use was exploding. And he studied, so if you come up with more efficient ways to use coal, will that decrease coal use? And you would think so, because if it used to take you, you know, 1 ton of coal to run your factory for a day, and you figure out a way to make it so it only takes a half a ton of coal to run your factory for a day, that's great. You should be using half a ton of coal, and that should spread out all over, and we should reduce coal use. But it's the opposite. What happens is if you make coal use more efficient, it becomes more economically feasible to increase the size of your factory. So it actually increases coal use. Think of it this way, which would end up using more gas? If you had cars that went 1 mile per gallon, or you had cars that went 100 miles per gallon? And it seems pretty obvious that 100 miles per gallon would be less gas, except the truth is, if they only went 1 mile per gallon, nobody would have a car at all.
Right.
And the other day, an example of this, when I was riding Bright Green Lies, is one day I drove 5 miles to get some really good tacos. And the car gets 30 miles a gallon, say. I think it gets better. Let's say 40 miles a gallon. Then that means I used a total of 10 miles. So I used a quarter gallon. So at $2, that's 50 cents. That's fine. I'll pay an extra 50 cents for my tacos. But if I only got 1 mile per gallon, that would be 10 gallons for 10 miles. That would be, let's say gas is $2. I think it's $3 now, but we'll just call it two to make the math easy. That's 20, that's $40 for the tacos. I'm not going to buy the tacos, which means I actually use less gas.
Right.
And it's the same with everything else. I mean, I live in Northern California, where one of the major cottage industries is marijuana. And let's say you have a marijuana grow where you're spending $1,000 a month on electricity, and then you get these new miracle lights that are twice as effective. So you cut your electricity in half. Well, A, you could save that $500 a month and, you know, protect habitat, or you can be a good capitalist and you can double your grow size and probably triple your profits for the same amount of energy. And then you're using all these other inputs, you're using more fertilizer, using more water, using more of everything else. So Jevons paradox, basically what this means in the real world is that every time we as a culture have added on a new energy source. So it was mainly wood for a long time. When they added coal, wood did not go down. Coal added to it. When they added oil, coal and wood did not go down. When they added hydro, coal, oil, wood did not go down. When they added solar, coal, oil, wood, hydro did not go down. Every single time. So the whole thing is a big con.
And why do you think that this has been latched onto then as a solution?
Because it's easy, and because we can more easily conceptualize and accept the death of all life on Earth than we can the end of industrial civilization.
Wow. That's a heavy statement.
Yeah. Well, I think it's true. I mean, there's an article I just read yesterday. I've read literally hundreds of articles like this where the article was a climate scientist from Australia in this case saying there are major tipping points being reached because of global warming that will significantly harm the planet, and this will mean that civilization can't continue. It's like, what? What? That's the problem? The problem is not that the oceans could be devoid of fish. The problem is not that coral reefs will go extinct. The problem is not that whales might go extinct. That's the problem. And so many of the climate activists, Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, Lester Brown, all these people, they say explicitly. So I had an interesting exchange with Bill McKibben many years ago. And I want to say explicitly, nobody has done more to raise awareness of global warming than Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben is tireless. He is selfless. And I got an email from him several years ago saying, hey, I've heard you've been saying bad things about me behind my back. And so I would hope that if you were doing that, you would have the respect to say them to my face. And I wrote back. I thought it was great. You know, it's a very healthy, emotionally healthy attitude. You know, he wasn't mean. He was just, let's talk about this. So I wrote back to him and said, so the same thing I just said to you, that nobody has done more work, tireless, selfless. I said, but here's what I say behind your back, which I say in public, I will say anywhere, which is you keep saying that you want to save civilization. And that makes me really sad, because what is worth saving is the planet. What's at stake? He says most people don't realize that civilization is at stake. I say most people don't realize that life in the oceans is at stake, that the buffalo are at stake, that the frogs are at stake. And so it was a fine exchange, a fine and emotionally healthy exchange, I think. But we have a fundamental difference in values. And, you know, Naomi Klein says this explicitly, and this changes everything. She says, I've been to more climate marches than I can count, but I have to tell you that the polar bears just don't do it for me. This is about us. And and we repeat that in Bright Green Lives. We repeat that many times. We say, well, look, we're not repeating it to be snarky. We're repeating it because it is a fundamental difference in values. And this book is not, even though we have 600 or 500 pages of facts, this book is not about those facts. It's not about the Jevons paradox. It's not about what happens when you put in, what happens to desert tortoises or to birds when you put in a solar harvesting facility in the desert and the birds will burn to death when they fly over the mirrors. It's not about those facts. It's about the values. And we value life on the planet more than we value industrial energy supply. That's where I come down on, you know, back to the Democrat thing, is the Democrats have fully bought into that bright green technotopic future, and it's going to kill the planet. And it's a good cop, bad cop thing. I mean, it's and one of the places I really learned that, again, Clinton taught me a lot about politics, because George Bush, I don't remember if I voted for Clinton or not, but I thought about it. I either did or I thought about it. And the reason was that George Bush, the first, said that he wanted to get rid of the Endangered Species Act. And Bill Clinton defended it. But once Bill Clinton got into power, he administratively weakened the ESA. he talked a good game, but when, and he said he was going to protect it, but he did things like defunding parts of it by putting in people who were more interested in resource extraction than they were in protecting endangered species into positions of power, by making it so you had to, even more so than before, sue Fish and Wildlife to get them to do the right thing. And so I learned it doesn't matter. They are both. The Democrats and Republicans are, vis-a-vis global warming, taking us straight to hell. And one of them, the path will be lit by oil, and the other one, the path will be lit by oil and solar.
Let me ask you something about the whole trying to save civilization, because I'm on board that we should absolutely concentrate on saving marine life, frogs, all you know, and strengthen the Endangered Species Act, etc. My only open question for me, when we talk about the demise of civilization, any way that could happen, I think would cause a lot of unnecessary suffering. And here's something perhaps I could ask you. I talked to a wildlife biologist, Craig Packer, who he started the Serengeti Lion Project, which helped preserve lions in the Serengeti and so on. He's someone who cares a lot about wildlife. That being said, I asked him his take on civilization as a whole, as a construct, and he believed it was a net positive because, and his justification was something along the lines of, yes, there's been terrible crimes committed in order to raise this civilization off the ground, but you look at things like infant mortality being reduced, disabilities human. And ailments and so on, and that perhaps in his argument, I don't know if it's true or not, but in his argument, that is a net positive, and that therefore civilization is worth saving. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think Mesopotamian elephants would agree. I don't think Arabian ostriches would agree. Passenger pigeons, sea mink, Labrador ducks, coho salmon, pink-tusked black elephants from Africa, dodo birds, any of the thousands of species of frogs driven extinct.
Mm.
I think we need to recognize that on a finite planet, you cannot consume the planet and have a livable planet. And I mean, I would be dead without modern medicine multiple times. And that doesn't alter the fact that modern medicine is not sustainable. And all of this that we have, I mean, it's really cavalier to dismiss, to say, well, I mean, of course, okay, picture this. You live in a neighborhood. Okay, you live in an apartment building. How big's your apartment building?
Maybe 5 stories.
Okay, so what? 400 people live there, let's say?
About, yeah.
Okay, so let's say that... do you want to be one of the winners or losers?
I suppose I'd prefer to be a winner.
Okay, so you, what floor are you on?
Second.
Okay, you and the people on the second floor all decide that everything everybody else has in the apartment building belongs to you. And so you go to the fifth floor and you kill the people in apartment 514 and you take everything that's theirs. And then the people in apartment 517, you find out their bank account and you drain it. Well, you know, this arrangement is a net positive because now it means that right. You can, so you see where I'm going with this, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So of course we think that this works out great for us because we get a lot of benefits. I like hot showers. I like electric blankets. I like space heaters. All these have to do with heat. That's because I'm cold. And that doesn't alter the fact that there are those who are paying for this. And we're stealing from everybody else on the planet. And so, of course, we like it. And of course, we don't want it to end. And of course, we are very, very concerned that this way of life could be threatened by global warming, by whatever. And, you know, if I had to summarize all of my work in one or two sentences, it would be, this way of living won't last. And when it's over, I would prefer that there is more life left on the planet rather than less. So we can say, yeah, it's really great that we have lower levels of infant mortality among the rich, at least, by the global elite. I mean, I don't mean simply capital R rich people in the U.S. I mean, anybody in the United States pretty much is a member of the global elite, as opposed to, you know, the third of the people who are living in extreme poverty, who would be better off, by the way, without civilization. I mean, that's part of it, too. When we talk about civilization causing unnecessary deaths with its collapse, it's like, which deaths are we talking about? We talk about hammerhead shark people, coho salmon people. You know, so first off, the non-humans are just completely erased from our perspective. The humans in the future are erased, because if there are any humans left 100 years from now, they're going to be asking why we weren't fighting like hell when the world was going down. They're going to be asking, they're not going to care about what our level of infant mortality was or whether we were able to buy things on Amazon. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water and whether the land can support them. And I have a friend who was married to a guy from Bangladesh. And when he was a kid, his mother would say, go get lunch. So go to the river, and he would go fish, and he would bring back a fish for lunch for his family. And now the river's so polluted that they can't get any fish from it. There's no fish in the river. And if somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 50 years ago, the people in his community could still eat those fish. Mm. And if people would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, people in the eastern part of the United States could still eat passenger pigeons, and people in the West could still eat salmon. And we are rapidly lowering the planet's carrying capacity for humans. And I don't understand why even the people who are anthropocentric don't seem to be worried about that. What they want to do is maintain what's happening. And, you know, honestly, and if I were made in charge of the whole thing, if I were a dictator of the planet, I would not deindustrialize in 5 minutes.
Right.
I would every cell in my body wants for us to have some sort of slow descent, where first thing we do is get rid of retractable stadium roofs and golf courses, you know, get rid of stuff that's just completely unnecessary. And then second thing we do is, I don't know what we do after that, but the point is, you know, go with the stuff that, I mean, basically the last lights I would turn out would be in the hospital. You see what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah.
But I don't think we're going to do that. What we're going to do, here's a story I love to tell. When I was a kid, well, so funny. I'm sitting here on a couch, and there's a printer over here, and there are papers all over the floor. And I was just going to say, when I was a kid, I was messy, but of course there are papers all over the floor. So who are we kidding? Anyway, when I was a kid, I was messy. And my mom would often say to me, you need to clean your room. And I wouldn't do it. And then finally, my mom would get tired of it. And she would say, look, either you clean your room but before dinner, or I'm going to clean it. And if I clean it, you're not going to like it because I'm throwing everything away. And what I wish, but nature is sort of saying the same thing. That's like, look, you can clean up your act. If you don't, I'm going to clean it up for you, and you're not going to like it because I'm going to throw everything away.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, this will include, you know, taking a lot of others down with us. The thing is that, anyway, so that's my response to all that.
No, were you going to say something else?
So I'm going to have to go in a few minutes. So we should start thinking about winding down for today.
Okay.
But I'll do it again. This has been fun.
Great. This might be too extended of a question, but I was curious. Have you read Ted Kaczynski's manifesto about, you know, industrial civilization and its discontents?
Yeah, I read that, gosh, back when it first came out in the, I don't know, Washington Post or New York Times or wherever it was that he had them print it. I haven't read it for a long time, but I read it 25 years ago or whenever it came out.
Obviously, you don't agree with his methods, but he was not a dumb guy, and he made some good points, I would say, at least in that paper.
He was absolutely right that industrial civilization is alienating. It's certainly not helping the planet. It's also not helping us. I mean, it's helping us, as you said earlier, with infant mortality rates, but psychically we did not evolve in this circumstance, and we could spend entire days just talking about like the effects of television or the effects of what internet pornography is doing to our psyches, what the internet itself does to our psyches. Oh, for God's sake, I couldn't believe this. The other day, I said something, and actually, Obama said essentially the same thing the next day. And of course, the point is that it was just weird that he and I were thinking the same thing, almost the same words. That one day it occurred to me that the greatest threat to what's left of American democracy are the big communication companies, the big social media, Viacom, television companies, Netflix. Those are the biggest threat because they've so concentrated the ability to propagandize. And Obama said pretty much the same thing the next day. It was very interesting to me. It's just interesting that we had parallel evolution on that particular thought. Oh, so yes, I agree that all of those are antithetical to community, to communal, to psychological and emotional health. I just got to know that they said that they got off Facebook like 2 years ago, and it was a really rough week as they basically broke their addiction. But then they thought that was the best thing they'd done in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
There are many things I did agree with in his documents.
Okay. Well, I know you got to go, so I don't want to take up any more of your time. But is there anything you want to plug or get off your chest before we go here? You got a book?
No, I think I think this is really fun, and I mean I'm glad that we got to what you wanted in time, but also it was really fun to talk about bears for a half hour.
I agree, absolutely. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, and not to be too self-promoting, but maybe after Lies comes out, we can do one on Bright Green Lies.
That would be perfect, actually. I would love to do
that. And that comes out early March.
Perfect. All right, Derek, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you to Derek Jensen, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Yammy. See you next time.